Session number 12392, Mr. D. Mile, Reel 1.
Mile, Reel 1. And if I could ask you then, first of all, David, you know, something about your background, where you were born, brought up, and the sort of family life.
Okay. I was born in 1951. The first child of two children born to parents and who were Missourians, St. Louisans both. And my earliest memories were of rural Missouri and rural Oklahoma, Midwestern places in the United States. And my father was a parish parson in a Protestant denomination in the Midwest. And so my most primitive memories were of churches and small towns, essentially on the prairie, if you will. In my early elementary years, after my sister was born, the other child in our family, we moved to the St. Louis community where my parents became involved at Eden Theological Seminary, my father on the faculty and my mother doing some early childhood educational work in the St. Louis area. Being brought up in a middle-class suburban community outlying St. Louis, then in my formative years, elementary years through high school, my recollections are of an interesting creative conflict, if you will, between the suburban middle-class predominantly white, fairly conservative tradition of the community, and then the more liberal, sometimes even progressive to radical community of Eden Seminary, where I spent a good deal of my time as a child. My schools and my friendships were fostered in the rather conservative Webster Groves community, but my politics and my thinking and my early theological and, if you will, social thinking were formed at home and on the seminary campus, and there were some differences between the two, particularly as a young teenager coming up through the civil rights movement, being aware, because my family was terribly interested in and the seminary was very involved in, early civil rights demonstrations, early civil rights activities, both in the St. Louis area through fair housing efforts and civil rights efforts locally, and then beyond the local scene to the Deep South when the marches were happening and the sit-ins and other demonstrations were going on. I was formed, if you will, very much by the religious and political mix of an activist Christian faith where people rolled up their sleeves and embodied their belief in decency and fairness and justice rooted in the biblical tradition. So I saw with my own eyes and interpreted in my home and around the seminary as a kid growing up some of the struggles with violence on the one hand by status quo people, white Southerners, if you will, protecting their world, and the nonviolent response, mostly in those early years, of Dr. King and Ralph Abernathy and Southern Christian Leadership Conference leadership people, as well as rank-and-file working people across the South who clearly embodied something different from the culture they were struggling with. Their sit-downs, their prayer vigils, their sit-ins, their bus rides all bespoke of an alternative vision for problem-solving, which was resisted by the culture at large, but finally, in many ways, was victorious as schools and buses and restaurants and public facilities across the South were integrated. The reason that had such an early impact on me, juxtaposing nonviolent strategies against violent defense mechanisms, was because there were seminary students who were 15 or 20 years older than I, who were mentors for me, who traveled to the South from their seminary places with the full awareness and support of their faculty members in those years, early to mid-60s, and participated in the activities which marked the course of the civil rights movement. In some cases, students as well as faculty members were jailed, and in several cases were even beaten by local police authorities. And that word and those stories traveled back from the Deep South to the seminary campus. And as a young teenager, I was wide-eyed and greatly touched and formed by, again, the contrast between their nonviolent strategies and means in problem-solving vis-a-vis the use of force, billy clubs and tear gas and hoses and political violence used against those early strugglers. I would say that my whole orientation for problem solving, both in a personal way as well as in a more global way, was richly formed by my earliest teenage years and by the mentors who embodied another way for me. Then came, historically, for the world as well as for me as an older teenager, the hard choices about military service and conscription. Vietnam was raging by the time I was in my late high school years. Lyndon Johnson was president. And while having a relatively decent and progressive record on civil rights, he lost ground and lost control of the domestic program, I believe, in his unswerving effort to win Vietnam at whatever military cost was necessary. Vietnam was not winnable, and the use of institutional and organized violence through massive troop buildups and sophisticated chemical weapons and heavy artillery, as well as bombardment both of North Vietnam and Cambodia, simply did not changed the minds and hearts of Southeast Asian people. I could see it as I grew, and personally for me, as I watched evening news reports at home as a high school boy and began over the evening meal to sense the tragedy of body counts through those years and know that there were boys in school several years ahead of me who were going off to fight in Vietnam, and some enlisting and some wondering whether they should, and some beginning even to think of ways of resisting. I then, by the time I turned 18 and had to register for the draft, had to make a difficult choice. But out of my awakenings in the civil rights movement, out of my nurture in my home and on the seminary campus, in some ways, in contrast to my suburban experience in school and in the community of a very conservative Webster Groves, I decided that to fight in Vietnam, to join the army, and to go overseas to become another statistic in a body count was simply unacceptable, not only for me personally, but also for me as a matter of conscience and Christian conviction. As the college years approached, then I was involved in my college community in some anti-war demonstrations, in some draft resistance. I sought counsel from the American Friends Service Committee, the Quakers organization, who in those late 60s and early 70s were very involved in draft counseling, who helped me articulate a position statement, a faith statement, if you will, which was a statement of conscience, an affirmation of nonviolent solutions to global as well as in personal problems. And I wrote or drafted a statement to ready it for my own time of dealing personally with conscription. The college years did offer deferment for those of us who were fortunate enough to be middle class, fortunate enough to have the financial means and or scholarship options to be in college. And as long as we were in college, and as long as our lottery number didn't come up and we were high enough in the lottery system to avoid conscription, we were blessed. Therefore, through my own conviction, as well as my fortunate status as a middle-class kid, I did not serve and did not then go to military service at all. Although it did occur to me, and I had a great deal of support from home as well as from close friends, that if my lottery number did come up and if I were called, that I would probably either resist or go to Canada. That the last option for me, which really wasn't even an option, would have been to be drafted.
Could you tell me about the lottery numbers you've mentioned? What that sort of system was?
About 1969-70, the Selective Service System of the United States developed a lottery system, which is simply a lottery. It was all persons born in a given year, turning 18, would by the date of their birth be given a particular number. It would almost be drawn out of a tumbler, if you will. And if you were born on January 1st, as the wheels spun, the officials of the Selective Service System, as I recall now, I'm a little bit foggy on this, but as I recall, would simply pull a number, 1 to 365. And if your number was 362, you were very safe, in that it was highly unlikely that an 18-year-old with that high of a number pulled during his year of potential conscription would be called. So he could either retain his student deferment or be classified 1A, which would be draftable. But if the system did not move through the calendar year far enough toward his number 363 or whatever it might be, he could be 1A and be vulnerable but not be called, and then having been 1A and vulnerable, the time the next year came around, he would be no longer eligible to be called. If, however, your birthday was October the 3rd and that tumbler brought forth a number 12 or 27 or 110 or whatever, the chances then were very likely a hard choice would need to be made, because you could then be called. The lower your number in the system, the more likely you could be called for duty. If called, then you had to either be conscripted, or there were a number of alternative options, but the lottery forced the issue.
So really there was this feeling, am I right in thinking, that of insecurity due to that? You could, you know, even if you were in college, a lot depended on your number and, you know, what happened in that lottery.
I remember the night that the lottery was given over the radio, and a huge group of us, young men and women, friends alike, huddled together in the student lounge of our college as the numbers were read. The date of birth, you know, whatever the date would be, and then the subsequent number. And it was a bit like Russian roulette, if you will, with all of us there. None of those of us who were college-oriented were interested in leaving behind our friends and college coursework and career plans and so forth. We were middle class. We were upwardly mobile, economically reasonably secure. We were not blue-collar kids, by and large. Therefore, we felt we had some choices. This system relinquished or took from us our sense of having choices, and thereby left all of us feeling very insecure. There were men, young men, I remember, as their numbers came up, if it was low, they wept openly. There were other men whose numbers were high that evening who leapt for joy. And it was a real roller coaster ride through the evening as we waited for the announcement of the number for those of us who were turning 18. Insecurity would be the right description for that feeling for all of us.
Also, I was thinking, you know, it was a long war, wasn't it? It went on for 10 years, and college doesn't last that long. So, you know, was it always this sort of ghost at the end of it that you might have to go after you'd finished your studies? Was that, you know, something to be considered as well?
It was a continual discussion throughout our college years. And my college years would have been from the fall of 1969, to give it historic perspective, to the fall, winter of 1973, about a 4.5-year spread. Particularly in the late 60s and into the first 2 or 3 years of the 1970s, the war had continued to escalate. And people were forced by lottery or economic insecurities or whatever reasons or family pressures or simply, in some cases, the lack of clarity about future would drive men into military service. But at the same time, there was an increasingly active and vociferous and organized anti-war movement which pulled upon many of us in the other direction. I think for those of us on college campuses, the latter would have been the stronger pull, the pull of the anti-war forces and the pull of the role of conscience and even the war of the role of simply the resistance to authority at all levels, governmental as well as even academic. And as we all recall in those years, student strikes and student demonstrations were enacted not only against Vietnam but against all sources really of authority in those years. It was a time of tumult and uncertainty, a time very unsettled for all of us, but also a time of great promise as fundamental questions were being asked by young people about the systems which we all would inherit. After college, Vietnam wound down in a very disgraceful way. I recall about 1975 that as a young man who was now out of college with a BA degree in history, working in Minneapolis, St. Paul, Minnesota, that the evacuation of Saigon took place and the war ended. And so the most personal, most immediate threat of conscription or the war visiting us in a personal way was relieved. But I also remember in those years the feeling of tragedy in the years of the war and in the very clear ways that the war and the war mentality and the strategies of violence over a Southeast Asian people simply were futile. Those policies at the highest levels of government which were enacted upon the American people simply did not work. And there was a sense, I think, for the nation, both those who resisted as well as those who served, of humiliation, of grief, of great sadness at the incredible loss of human life, American as well as Southeast Asian, the incredible loss of natural resources to fuel and foster the war effort, and the incredible loss of national direction and pride and conscience, which no matter how one felt about Vietnam, no matter which side one took, I think by the mid-1970s, many people on both sides of the issue of the rightness or the wrongness of Vietnam and its years felt a great sense of disgrace and horror at its outcome and the long-term implications on us as a society. And in many ways, in the mid-70s, I don't believe that any of us as ordinary Americans realized the depth of the impact which the war and its byproducts would have on the whole culture.
How far do you think the media was responsible for that? You know, were you getting really accurate information about that war, would you say? Was that an important factor? I was thinking of your images, you know, on the television screen. And it's interesting perhaps comparing this with the Gulf War, mm-hmm. you know, if you think there was a difference between the two.
My impression now at age 40, looking back over several different incursions, including the Gulf, including other efforts at stabilizing, if you will, difficult situations, is that the media over the course of the post-Vietnam era was kept farther and farther out of the loop, was controlled more in more sophisticated ways by the Pentagon and even by the White House, and that Vietnam was the last season in which the media had front lines access to the feelings of soldiers, to the real experience of war. I think that's all changed. I think since Vietnam, those persons and institutions who most benefit from maintaining sophisticated war efforts see the media as adversarial and attempt in every way possible to control their activity and to bring them the news as it fits their purposes rather than the news as it happens and as it grows from the lives of ordinary people. So I think we've seen a great change in the availability of access to truth.
Could I ask you also, you know, about the business of being a conscientious objector in the Vietnam War? Were you aware yourself of the procedure for this and the alternatives open to you, you know, if it came to that?
If it had come for me to the necessity to bear witness by conscientious objector status, code word 1-0 status, I knew what my alternatives were because I had very good counseling from American Friends Service Committee representatives, Quaker groups, and was aware through my connections to religious institutions which would have supported me, college chaplain's office, Eden Seminary faculty and friends, Quaker organizations, what my choices were. There would have been non-violent alternatives to service in the military in those years, and I was fully aware of them. The least desirable would have been to leave the country, on the one hand. The most undesirable for military service would have been to be conscripted and to serve. In between those were hospital or chaplaincy work, community service work locally or in some place in the country, or even medical work on a military site. And that would have been less desirable to me than work, say, in a local hospital. But were I to have had to make a choice, I would have preferred service even in a military hospital to aid the wounded rather than to have been in service with them. Not because I didn't care for my brothers in service, and not because I ever held any animosity for those who chose to go, but for me it was not that comparative posture. It was simply a matter of personal conscience. I knew that I couldn't, because I knew it for me only, it was wrong. And in every way that I could say it and write it and embody it, I tried. But I had friends who went, and it grieved me that they did, because I felt it was wrong and I was afraid they would be brought home dead. But I was never one who took an aggressive, negative posture against my brothers who did go to war. I never understood it, but I never felt that it was my place to attempt to somehow physically or mentally force them to change their mind. And those were difficult days for all of us. There were friendships, I know, which were marked by those years. And people in different communities, including my own, made tough choices. So,
did you find there was animosity towards people who went? You know, was this sometimes manifested?
Yes, there was animosity. I'll be autobiographical. I recall my first year in college being involved in an anti-war demonstration on a small campus in the north central part of the United States, and remember dressing up as a Vietnamese peasant. There were probably 12 of us, and we put on black robes and straw hats, and we moved as, it was called guerrilla theater, if you will, and it was quickly moving, dramatic activities in public places on college campuses, in the dining hall, in libraries, on football fields at the time of homecoming games. And on several occasions I was involved with other radical students in guerrilla theater activities, which were meant to be disruptive, to show, to bring to the attention of larger groups of people the plight of Southeast Asians as we somewhat naively understood it in those years, but to dramatize, usually without words, just with bodies, scenes of destruction and death as it might look were we all in Vietnam, to heighten people's consciousness that the war, even on college campuses, was present, and that even through a football game or a lunch line or a quiet library, we couldn't escape the realities and horrors of Vietnam. The struggle in that came in one occasion I remember vividly, when involved in a demonstration in which all of us went limp on the floor, a number of students punching and kicking us and calling us a variety of names, who fervently disagreed with our tactics. While we might have been able to discuss deeper issues with them were we all quiet and dressed similarly and not advocating our disobedience in quite the outspoken and public way that we did, we may have had a lot to talk about. Our means were subversive and quick and dramatic, and it was never clear to me whether their kicking and scuffling and name-calling was so much their disagreement with us about the war as it was their disagreement with us about our tactics and strategies. our approach. But in any case, the feelings ran high, and there were many nights, many discussions on campuses, my own included, where people almost came to blows over Vietnam and over the whole war effort in those years. I do recall the day when I was lying on the floor in my demonstration posture, and I was kicked and screamed at and called a variety of names, that when the demonstration was over, I left with my colleagues the building where we were demonstrating, and out on the lawn in front of the student commons, we had erected a series of crosses bearing the names of war dead from Minnesota as a way, again, of quietly but dramatically demonstrating the war coming home to all of us. And as I went toward my dormitory to change my clothing, a young